From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made every time you need a pharmaceutical of some kind. The drug you choose or the drug that perhaps a doctor chooses for you is the result of a long process, plenty of trial and error, a lot of error, leading eventually to success, we hope. It can be a very expensive process. This hour we examine how it happens and how new research being performed right here could improve matters in many ways. It's our monthly science roundtable, and the subject is something that's going to impact just about every one of us, now or eventually. Drugs, how they're made, how science is making them more effective. Let's first welcome our panel. Damian Creason is an associate professor at the University of Rochester, the co-vice chair of research in the Department of Pediatrics. Damian, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Daniel Weichs is here. He's an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, too.
Michael Neidig is an assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry. Michael, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And before we get to the subject at hand, because we're talking about health today, it was a good time to have a quick visit from my colleague Michelle Faust, whose work continues and is ramping up, in fact, understanding the Affordable Care Act. What's going on, Michelle?
That's right. Last week, we launched our website, and you can follow the link from WXXI.org to the website that is Understanding the Affordable Care Act. And you can see our reporting on innovations in health, any kind of questions that you have about the Affordable Care Act, about your health insurance, and paying for the medications that we'll be talking about today. Even when we get the costs down, people always have questions about the cost and what is that associated to their health care. So you can go ahead and check that out. If you have questions about the Affordable Care Act, we ask you to go to our website, WXXI.org, and follow the link there to the website. Look at some of that reporting, and you can take our survey, and you can still go ahead and do that survey. Let us know what your questions are, or send us an email directly at ACAWXXI@WXXI.org. Follow us on Twitter, #ACAWXXI.
Before you ask about pharmaceuticals and the cost, though, listen to this hour. Then there's a lot of places.
We will be
to go.
Definitely following
yes,
up
indeed.
On that as
yes,
well
indeed.
As many other innovations when it comes to healthcare.
Absolutely. Michelle, thank you very much and great work. It's going to be very interesting to see some of the questions and comments that come in on understanding the Affordable Care Act. All right, we're talking about the world of the creation of pharmaceuticals, and I want to start with the question of how we make distinctions between, you know, sort of, I said trial and error, but really it's discovery and then actual trials. And Damian Creason, when it comes to trials, for those of us not in the industry, mm-hmm. we hear trials, we hear they're very expensive. We may imagine a world in which, well, a trial is just kind of starting from scratch and you figure out if certain things can work. It's not exactly that way.
No, it's it is the most costly part of the drug discovery process, which can really be, I think, best broken down into two parts. Discovery, which happens well before the trial, and then once a very promising candidate is selected, those move forward into clinical trials, which proceed in three phases. You may hear in the news phase one, phase two, and phase three. And just to briefly go to phase one is essentially you give the medication to healthy people who don't have disease and make sure you don't make them unhealthy. The second phase is where the drug gets tried in patients who have the disease you're trying to treat. And once two is over, it goes into a very large clinical trial. And that's where generally where side effects and other sort of unexpected things appear, because you have a very large patient population that gets exposed to the drug. And so very rare things, which you may have missed in smaller populations of patients that were studied earlier, those come along. And they are hundreds of millions of dollars get spent on this sort of testing in the trial process.
Damian's background allows not only for us to understand so the research process on the science side, the industry side as well, and I'd like you to just tell me a little bit about your background working as the team that developed one of the first HIV inhibitors. Tell us about that.
So about 20 years ago now, actually, the world of HIV therapy was essentially revolutionized by the introduction of what are called protease inhibitors. And these are the highly active retroviral therapies that essentially converted HIV from a death sentence into a treatable chronic disease that it is right now in resource-rich parts of the world where we have access to those medications. So I had the good fortune of being in the chemistry team that developed the first HIV protease inhibitors. And one of the big challenges that is relevant to our other guest's work here is that, first of all, a number of molecules were tried in animal testing, which were very toxic. And so we tested a bunch of different drugs that looked for all the world just like the other one. And only one of those was actually had low enough toxicity to move forward. And then the other big issue we had in that time was that this was one of the most complicated medicines ever made. And the chemistry was crucial in order for us to deliver this drug. And usually it's early stage of the development. You don't need a lot of drug because you're only treating a small number of patients. But in this case, we were pretty certain this was going to be a very effective medication if it worked. And we were going to need to leave people on that medication. So we had to make a lot of it, way more than we normally did, because we use compassionate use, if you will, to continue treating the patients once the trial was over.
Okay. And again, staying with that distinction of discovery versus actual trial, when you talk about the first stabs at creating an inhibitor being so toxic, that was in the discovery phase.
That was in the discovery phase. And so in the discovery phase, the name of the game is make as many molecules that you can. It's sort of like you have a therapeutic area, you have an enzyme you want to inhibit, you have a bacteria you want to kill. The more flavors of one type of drug that you can create, the more likely you are to find one that's going to be successful. We were talking earlier, the analogy being, if you want to have a really good basketball team, are you going to go to New York City and look for the players in New York City where there are 15 million folks? Or are you going to go to my hometown in Brookings, South Dakota, where there are 15,000? More likely, you're going to find a really good basketball player in New York than you are in Brookings. And the chemistry is crucial to essentially creating that chemical diversity that you can analyze and then know that you've done the best job of trying to find the best molecule to move forward. Because once you start moving forward into the phase 1, 2, 3 clinical trials, that's where all the money gets spent. That's where things get really expensive. The early part of drug discovery is not as expensive, but you have to lay the groundwork so that you know that your molecule moving forward is really optimal.
We're here to talk about the technical side, but I must ask, given the way the HIV, frankly, the AIDS crisis happened in the 1980s mm-hmm. into the 90s, it's amazing to me even now, when you talk about HIV, how many people still think, that's a death sentence. Even now.
Yeah.
And then you read someone like Andrew Sullivan or some people who are living with it, some well-known people. And it's just a reminder of what has changed in 20 years. That must be remarkable to be on your end of it to see that change.
Yes. So in my field of pediatrics, we are actually, our patient population, at least in this country, is going away. I almost never see pediatric HIV because the prophylaxis and the therapies that are used in mothers essentially is eliminated prenatal transmission to young babies. So we don't see it anymore. The medications have truly, when we do see patients who have HIV, let's say a young adolescent who contracts it, the first thing you want to find out is they always ask, how long have I got? Well, as long as you want. You take your medicines and you will stay alive. And that was not the case prior to the protease inhibitors.
So those rare patients who need the help come in thinking it is a death sentence now. Yeah, really, really remarkable stuff. And before I kick it over to your colleagues, I do want to ask you, because you have been on really all sides of this, there is occasionally the notion that pharmaceutical industry in general is a pejorative. And that, I know you've heard that. Can you say a word about working on all the different sides and generally what you've seen?
So, yes, the pharmaceutical industry certainly has gotten its fair share of bad press. And like anything, a few bad apples, if you will, can really poison the well. The folks that I have worked with, the folks that I know who work in the pharmaceutical industry, on all sides of it are, for the most part, they're there to do good science and help people, just like, and you know, us in medicine, all of biomedical research. So it's dedicated, really smart, hardworking people trying to get a job done, which is to develop best medicines they can.
Now, when you were working on HIV, and someone right now is working on Ebola, right? I mean, I assume there's a big difference between creating something as a treatment that doesn't currently exist, and then compared to creating something that tinkers with existing therapy and making it better, right?
Right. The trials we do now, for the most part, for most medicines, are trying to make something better, make it an antibiotic that treats something a little bit more effectively or longer acting, something like that. It is starting de novo is rare these days. But you know, either way, going back, the discovery process is where it all starts, and making that process as efficient as we can allows us to move forward in things, for instance, Ebola or whatever else, that we don't really have effective therapies right now. If we can't make molecules quickly, we're not going to be able to move quickly into trials. And so, you know, the chemistry that is being developed here at Rochester certainly is going to help, move that the process of discovery along.
All right, so let's back up and talk discovery. And I am fascinated by just a conversation we had before the show even started about some of the, is the word metals, compounds, that some of the materials that go into the creation of these pharmaceuticals and why the industry really needs this kind of research. So my understanding is, Michael Neidig, it was you who helped secure that $1.5 million NIH grant to study iron. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about iron, we're going to talk about nickel, and we're going to talk about palladium. And before our listeners go, oh, you've lost me already. Trust me, they're about to explain this in a way that was, for me, radical and interesting, and I did not know. So walk me through why iron matters so much, especially when you look at the other materials that are often used in pharmaceuticals.
Well, I think to describe the importance or the interest that currently exists in iron for a potential method to make new molecules that can be pharmaceuticals, it's first important to define what's more traditionally used. And that's more precious metal. We call them precious metal based systems, such as based on palladium or other metals that are just extremely expensive. Also, they tend to be very rare. Those systems have worked very well historically. They can do a wide variety of different reactions, different ways of building up molecules. And certainly they're relatively well understood. The challenge, of course, is moving forward, they come from regions of the world that can be somewhat unstable. So one worries about supply. There's also the cost issue. There's also toxicity issues. The research going on in my group is focused on iron, which has become a very popular alternative. Iron was actually discovered for these types of reactions before palladium, but iron is very, very complicated to understand. But we're not going to run out of iron. Just look around, any rusting steel structures full of iron. And also, importantly, it can do a lot of, come up with a lot of new ways to put molecules together that perhaps palladium does not. And there's already been some examples of that. But the issue is, it's very hard for my colleagues to work on new ways to use iron to make pharmaceuticals when one does not understand at all why it works.
Yeah, okay. And so is it fair to say that palladium was kind of a workhorse for many years because it's a little easier to understand, easier to manipulate or use?
That's certainly a big contribution, and it's still a workhorse in the field. There are plenty of people working on trying to get the amount of palladium down to a minimal level to inhibit cost. But yes, I would agree with that.
Where do we find palladium?
South Africa, Russia.
All the places that are easy to get to with really stable governments is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's a very limited number of production sites in the world. And so in addition to the fact that, if something happened in one of those countries, it would destabilize supply, there's also, a little bit of, let's say, price control that can be initiated when supply is in the hands of only a few producing companies.
All right, so now you're getting a picture of why palladium has been used, but why they want to broaden it. And Michael's research on iron, we're going to talk more about that in a moment. Daniel Weichs has been working with nickel.
Yes.
All right, so now we've talked about the difference between iron and palladium. How does nickel come into the equation?
Well, so I can go back and add a few things to what Mike said about palladium. So to give you an idea, there was analysis recently done of the types of chemistry used in the discovery process. So they looked at, these researchers looked at a broad spectrum of papers, and what they found was very interesting to me. I didn't even know this, even though I worked in cross-coupling and thought about this chemistry a lot, was that almost half of bond of new carbon-carbon bonds, this is kind of the bread and butter of organic chemistry. You need to make carbon-carbon bonds to build up your structure. Almost half of that chemistry is palladium-catalyzed reactions. And so that's a revolutionary. I mean, this is the reason why that chemistry was the subject of the 2010 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. So is that it's really changed the way we make molecules, but there are still real limits. So as Mike talked about the relative abundance of palladium, it's considered an endangered metal, to use a term that's kind
absolutely.
Of evocative, is that there's a real concern in industry is that once they're using palladium to make a drug, they can't change the process in the middle of production. And so for some reason, they couldn't get it for a month. They would not be able to produce their
There's
drug
no
for
alternative.
A month. Yeah, and so okay. you'd have a shortage. The drug wouldn't be on the market, and so this would be a catastrophe.
Can I jump in and ask, when you say an endangered metal, it's a finite resource, do we have a timeline for when it might not be available anymore?
So I think it's not realistic to think of it that it would be completely unavailable, and the reason for that is that it's valuable enough already that recycling is worth your time and money. And so to a large extent, it is recycled, but that keeps the price relatively high. Mm-hmm. And then there's just the fact that if used on production, especially, the quantity they need is a lot. And so what they're more worried about is a momentary lapse in supply. I think realistically, I don't think we're going to run out because it's, like I said, the recycling capacity for these precious metals is actually pretty good. I don't want people to think that they're going to run out and buy palladium and stockpile it in their house
sure.
or something.
So palladium is more expensive than nickel, which is more expensive than iron, is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So nickel and iron is, there's almost nothing that's cheaper than iron. You can get a lot of it from the dirt, outside. But nickel and iron are both so cheap and so commodity that we would never realistically run out of them. Nickel plating and things like that.
Does nickel have complications in the same way iron does, though, in terms of is it more difficult to work with for the creation of these pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, and I think the conversation, the way you put it earlier, was perfect. So palladium, why did that take off? Part of it was that it was easier for us to understand. This is the very beginning. Nothing that Mike and I do now could have been done without the palladium work happening first, right? We stand on the shoulders of those, right, who came before us. And so what we're seeing is a return to these more affordable but also more complicated metals now that we've understood how these things work from the palladium work, we can now finally attack these problems. And so nickel's more complicated than palladium, but I would say that that iron is even more complicated still. So
okay. Well, and that's why the work's being done here. If you want to join the conversation, by the way, and we're going to get to the phones in just a minute, it's toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 right here in Rochester. It's our monthly science roundtable. Here's Paul from Rochester with a question. Go ahead, Paul.
Good afternoon. For your panel, knowing how rare and how special a lot of these metals are, how did this country, as big as we are and major, allow China to be the major producer of all these rare metals and a lot of them that you've talked about? I get your research department, I've known for years, that we need certain metals, but nothing. I understand that out in near Las Vegas, they can extract it, but in order for us to catch up with China, we'd have to work around the clock.
All right, Paul, hold on there on the line for a second. Let's let our panel weigh in, and then we'll see if we can clear up some of this. Who wants
well,
to start?
One of the, ahead, Damien, yeah. One of the big problems with the supply is not so much who is, it's geographically limited. There are only mineable supplies of palladium, for instance, in, as we mentioned, South Africa or Russia. And, if there's none in the country that's really mineable, then you can't really do much about that.
I think it's an interesting question. And I think one of the things to think about is that it has to be economically viable, right? So we may have these metals here, but the price may not yet be high enough that it's economically worth your time to extract them. You see this all the time with gold or with oil even, right? That as the price fluctuates, then I think that's what we'd see. That's why I'd say I'm not sure that we'd completely run out of palladium, because as the price, as it got more and more scarce, the price would spike. But it takes time. It takes time to find these deposits, to figure out how to get at them.
Should money be a concern when people's lives are at stake? And if we have these, we should continuously to mine for them. And China is, as I said, the major producer, and they hold us by the neck in terms of pricing and everything.
Well, that's not really for palladium. To my knowledge, they're not a major producer of palladium, but they are a producer of the rare earths, and that's what you read about in the newspaper, and you see that these rare earths that have become increasingly important in electronics, not really in drug development, that they control a large portion of that. But what you've seen is that response to that, they used to control, I think, really have a stranglehold on it. But recently, that just drove further development and resources. And so now my understanding is that they don't actually quite have the control of the market. But that's not really my area of research. But my understanding is it's not as severe as it used to be.
Well, he's touching on the cost of pharmaceuticals in general, though. And let me again ask from a point of ignorance, because we're talking about palladium being more expensive and right now more widely used. Are the cost of pharmaceuticals more tied to directly to the materials made, to the cost of the trials? How do we break down what drugs cost?
The drug cost that is translated to what health patients and health plans pay is much more linked to how expensive the trials are. And certainly there is a component to the material itself. But many times that's not what's driving the price itself. And that's also why when we get to, for instance, generics, the price of a drug drops dramatically, because the generic producers are not having to recoup the costs, which are millions and millions of dollars, of running the trials. All they have to do is make the drug. And that's the mechanism by which generics are so much less expensive than so-called brand name, because the brand name company is trying to recoup the costs of proving that the drug actually works, whereas a generic company, they just have to do the chemistry as cheaply as they can, and their profit comes by what they can sell relative to how much it costs them to make it. So the generics price, the chemistry drives the cost of generics for the most part. Or more, has a bigger component.
All right, so Ben online is asking, on exactly that point, he wants to know, would this research lead to more generics and lower costs?
Well, I think as far as the number of generics, that's directly tied to the original discovery process and development process of new drugs, right? So generics are just the offshoot of a developed drug once the patent or the IP expires. And so developing more generics is tied to developing more drugs and more trials. But I do think that because the same type of processes are used to make it, right? If the original drug involves 10 palladium steps, right? The generic is most likely to involve 10 palladium steps. And so the type of work that Stan's doing with nickel or we're working on with iron offers the potential to lower cost on the generic side, where it's much more driven by how it's made. Once you've developed that a certain structure is an effective drug and that's approved, right, you could come up with alternative ways to make that drug that are less expensive and less toxic, as long as you get to the same end structure, right, which you know is effective. And so in that sense, it could have a significant impact.
And forgive me for asking this question, because I know so much has to be done with your research, Michael and Daniel, but how far down the line are we to seeing iron and nickel start to, I don't know if I want to say approximate the effects of palladium or even exceed some of the efficacy? Are we seeing a lot of, I assume we're seeing potential. I mean, that's why we're going in these directions, but are we starting to see more results?
So I guess I could say something. Our chemistries, we've been working on our chemistry longer than Mike has, and there are a number of pharmaceutical companies that are currently using the chemistry we've developed in my labs. And so most of this is in the discovery process, a little bit in production, but most of it's in discovery. But it's used at Merck, Novartis, I think Pfizer's Pfizer is maybe
What kind of therapies do you
describe? It's any therapeutic area. So the thing about chemistry is, you know, the main goal of my research is to kind of improve the diversity of the pool of molecules they start with. And so, frankly, they won't tell me exactly what they're using it for. That's proprietary. But they will tell me that they're using it and that it's successful. And the reason why they're interested in using it is our chemistry kind of further broadens the pool of things. So compared to palladium chemistry, when our chemistry kind of changes the types of, let's say, ingredients you can use, and we broaden that pool. So they have new kinds of things they can use and it's much easier to get access to more diversity. And so what's driving it there, I think, is less the cost. Because as Damien said, the cost isn't, in the big scheme of things, the cost of the palladium doesn't really alter the price at the end. But it's more the fact that they can get more molecules and have a better chance at finding something that will be the very best.
Roughly the same stage with you, Michael?
Yeah, it's roughly the same stage with iron. I would say in some respects, iron is further behind in some types of reactions and other types of reactions that are also used for making pharmaceuticals. I mean, Dan talked about putting two carbons together, and that's a very important reaction. But there are other reactions that one will do in the course of making a given molecule. And so there's certainly been some big effects there with iron as well, doing what's termed it's called a hydrogenation reaction. It's basically a reduction. And so that's another important transformation people will do as well. And that's where you've really started to see a lot of use of iron in pharmaceutical companies as well as other industrial areas as well.
So. All right. So on our monthly science roundtable, you've been hearing the discussion of how these scientific processes could lead to a more effective discovery stage, more options, right? I think that's what we're talking about, more options and potentially options that begin with less expensive and less rare-based materials, all of those good things. Doesn't necessarily change the fact that clinical trials are going to be expensive. That there's no silver bullet for that right now. And frankly, we understand, at least I would think, Damien, we understand that's an important part of the process. You cannot get around that.
There's certainly changes in trial design and things that are in the making to try to streamline that process in a safe way in order to improve the number of drugs that are being studied. And you'll still always have to try them one way or another.
All right. So let's take a very, very short break here and come right back with our Science Roundtable. More of your questions answered. And if you want to join the conversation, you can do it on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. You can call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 right here in Rochester. A lot of interesting questions coming in for our panel. And we welcome this hour Daniel Weichs, Michael Neidig, and Damien Creason. And we're talking about the future of pharmaceuticals and the research that's happening here. Stay with us. Coming up in our second hour, was climate change policy the biggest loser in last week's elections, both here in New York State and across the country? We now know that climate change policy is one of the most divisive political issues, and it was a big night for Republicans last Tuesday who opposed most major climate change policy. We're looking at what's next when it comes to climate and policy next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Writers and Books, introducing the debut novel series presenting tomorrow's authors today. Emerging first-time novelist Mira Jacob will be in Rochester November 13th through 15th. For details about this featured writer and the series, visit wab.org.
Welcome back to Connections on this Monday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson. It's our monthly science roundtable. And the question of the discovery process, again, in the creation of pharmaceuticals, we've been trying to create these distinctions, these boundaries, discovery, the trials, and production, three distinct phases. And in discovery, which is where a lot more of the, it can be a lot of error, but I mean, it has to be. You have to try new things. Really, the remarkable research that's happening in Rochester is helping improve that process. And Daniel Weichs was talking about the ways that they sometimes they'll want to target certain molecules or or kind of going with like a limited idea of what they would want. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Damien had mentioned it earlier really appropriately. The modern drug discovery, often there's a bacterium or there's a process, perhaps an anomalous process that's found in cancer cells, for example, that they target. And they think that if they can gum up this process, that they can then stop progression of the disease. And so this usually involves targeting even an individual enzyme, so a biological catalyst or signaling pathway. And they actually often understand that target at molecular detail, so they know exactly how it looks, the shape of the target. And they can choose then molecules that are shaped to fit perfectly into that target. And they're very good at this. And so they know they can't necessarily choose the winner right off the bat. It's too complex a process. But they have a good idea of what's going to work. So it's not, it's like fishing, but you know where the fish are. Sorry. So they put their hook in right by the fish. And so they maybe decide they want to make 10 molecules. The problem is right now is that those 10 molecules are probably the ones we want them to make. But they often can only make about half of them. So the chemistry is not sufficient to make every molecule that they want to make.
Can I ask why?
Well, it's a mixture of... the molecules are shaped a certain way, and then they have to kind of display, we call them functional groups. It's different collections of atoms that will interact with the target. And those functional groups often cause a lot of problems, and they can be either hard to get in the starting materials, or they can gum up the chemistry and make it fail. And so a lot of times they'll scratch them off. They'll say, with what we know about chemistry right now, we can't even make that. Or they'll try it and it won't work very well.
See, when you talk about the manipulation of groups, for me, it's so interesting that a couple of years ago when we reported on the synthetic marijuana boom, there was a question on, I'm trying to think of the plant. It's a cab.
Cannabis?
Cannabis.
No. Synthetic cannabis, which came from the cat. It's like QAT. It's a cat plant. But the manipulation of the different groups was how... Every few months, the law would change, and they would essentially manipulate the groups. So technically, it's legal, even though it has the same effect. Yeah. And for a while, the feds were really struggling with that. And in Rochester, we saw it as well. Now, you'll largely see very little what they would call bath salts, colloquially, or synthetic marijuana, because they've created more of a blanket catch-all law. But when they talked about the manipulation of the groups to sort of circumvent laws, it made it sound very easy. What you're saying is it's not always very easy to create the molecules you want.
It's always a question of time and money. So I don't want to give...
Cathinone, and they called it cat. It just hit in my brain.
Very
okay,
good.
Go ahead, sir.
So I guess I don't want to give people the impression that chemists can probably make anything that they can dream up. But it's a question of time and money. And so they don't have months to make something. But if you knew that one group would be the winner, right, you maybe would invest the months and you could make it. Drug discovery, because it's a game of many numbers... They can't spend a month for every compound because any one compound is unlikely to be the winner.
So we do this in my lab right now, generating as many collaborate with one of Dan and Mike's colleagues to generate. We know what the our target looks like now. We have molecules that inhibit it, and we can sort of make guesses about what is going to be good and bad. But when it comes down to it, we need to make 50, 100 molecules to really try and improve the activity of the molecule we have right now. And then I'll just bring in another secondary thing, which is the coming up with the actual activity on your target. So if you have a bacteria and you're going to target, kill it because it interferes with protein A, we can come up with a drug that does that. The bigger challenge is making it a molecule that can be swallowed by a human, can get into the bloodstream, get to the place where the infection is. Let's stay with that. Kill the bug, and then leave the patient alone. And so, generating again as many analogs, because we can't predict that anywhere near as well as we can predict what the activity of the that we were after is about. The more of those you have, just like when we had HIV protease inhibitors, we had a whole library of them. And when they didn't work at one stage, we just went back to that library and said, okay, well, let's try this other one. Their chemistry is going to be able to make that library much, much bigger.
A question from a listener, Jake asks, How identical is the end product with using different catalysts? I've heard some anecdotal accounts that some companies making generics cheaper by changing the chemistry synthesis ends up with a drug that will be chemically test the same as a brand drug but have less bioavailability or slightly increased side effects.
So that the chemical entity itself is going to be identical no matter how you make it. The formulation is what generally determines bioavailability. And bioavailability means when a patient swallows a pill, how much of what that patient swallows actually gets into his bloodstream or her bloodstream and goes and is effective. And that can be dramatically changed by how the pill is actually put together. That's a whole different part of pharmaceutical development. And frankly, I hope I'm not offending anybody who works in formulations, but it's bloody black magic compared to what we're doing right now, which is much more, theory-based, if you will. And the formulation is generally what's at the heart of a difference in bioavailability from a generic, let's say, from a brand. Because sometimes, in order for a generic company to get a drug approved, they actually have to demonstrate that their formulation is bioequivalent. I mean, that's the only thing the FDA wants from them is, did you make the right stuff and is it bioequivalent? So there can be changes in that, but it's usually formulation, not actual chemistry.
In other words, is what Jake's hearing about these anecdotes roughly on target? Or
I'm sure you can come up with examples where there have been problems with formulation in generics.
Okay.
I don't know that that's a widespread problem.
Okay.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I guess, as Damien was saying, these are for approved ones, right? So if you're buying it, online from God knows where, yeah, you could get something that, right? It may not even be the thing they say it is, right? So
let me get back to the phones here in just a second here. This is Doris in Rochester. Go ahead, Doris. You're on with our monthly science roundtable.
Okay, thank you. I had two questions. First, in the discussion about iron and the use of that in place of some of these other things, which would be a lot less costly, which I'm sure is going to be an important factor, my question was, what about, is there going to be some concern or taking into effect the whole issue of the effects of different types of iron, specifically ferritin, which is the basis of people who have hemochromatosis, and so adding more ferritin in their pill, especially without their knowledge, is going to be a real problem. Secondly, I just wanted to comment about the entire conversation about, the testing and whatever. In 1965, I was given a new drug, a new miracle drug, and it turned out that this drug had not been tested on women, and I ended up almost dying from it because it turned out it caused sterility and blindness in women, and they had no indication of that with men. I expect that the conditions and the rules have been tightened up since then, but I just want to point out that when we talk about all these trials and everything, it's great for the many, and all of these new drugs that will come on will help many people. But in the process, I think there has to be a lot of care for the individuals, and people are going to have side effects. And also, and as you've mentioned, in terms of the cost, I mean, I know a lot of situations where people have not been able to go for expensive drugs. So they, as a result of that, they don't get the benefit of the drugs because they can't afford them. And I'll listen to your comments off the air. Thank you.
Doris, thanks for the call. Let's start with the one of the last points regarding making sure people who are involved with trials, are things tighter, are they cared for?
Yeah, that trial design has come a long way since the mid-60s. And for reasons exactly what the caller is talking about, where now we do you pretty much have to explain why you're not including women or children in a specific trial. The trials are much larger, which is also why they're much more expensive. And then probably most importantly is now there's an extremely detailed and important what's called post-marketing surveillance, which means we run in these big trials, they will find some of these rare side effects and adverse events, but not all of them. And they really don't know what's going to happen with a drug until, you know, half the population of in the United States takes it because it's a new statin and it's an important medicine. We follow adverse events once the market, drug has reached the market. And so in indications about certain subpopulations of patients can be identified if there's a consistent problem, you know, with adverse events. So it's not perfect. There's certainly things that will still happen. And all medications, as I'm sure your doctors have told you, are risk-benefit ratios. There's no such thing as a perfectly safe medicine. And if it doesn't have much benefit, then you're not going to get, you know, it's going to fall on the side of too much risk.
And let me ask Michael Neidig, who is working with iron in this kind of research. She brought up concern with specific kinds. What do you make of that?
Well, first, let me say that the type of iron she mentioned, ferritin, is actually a very specialized type. It's actually an iron storage protein, basically. So it's basically a biological entity that's utilized for storing iron. And so that would affect very much where it goes because of the fact that it is biological in nature. But iron in and of itself, and that would not be used in any way in any of these types of developments because it would be very ineffective and very costly because of the bio component. But iron itself is very non-toxic. Even if I really wanted to right now, if I took just a basic iron salt, I could eat tons of this stuff, probably more than I could consume, and I'd be fine. And that's because, you know, a lot of our it's closed.
I'm not sure about that.
Might want to chime in.
Well, the ID 50 is actually very, very high, which is, you know, the point at which half the population would suffer serious medical consequences.
Is iron less toxic than palladium and then others?
Much less toxic.
Okay.
You know, probably tens of grams of iron versus a few milligrams of it.
Well, I was just going to chime in. So for the caller, this is something that is a major concern to the FDA. So anything that's in a drug over, I think, 0.1% has to be thoroughly analyzed and test for safety. And their thresholds for any metal, including iron, are incredibly low.
We used a very toxic metal in one of the early HIV syntheses, osmium, which is extremely toxic. And our levels that were for tolerance were on the order of parts per billion. It was, you know, the things that the iron and palladium and the metals we're talking about are things that are purified out of the final drug. They are not part of the final drug. And there are specific medications that incorporate iron that are used to replace iron, those are totally separate. So the just to be completely clear, the chemistry we're all discussing here is about making the molecule, and we purify away any of these salts and metals before it would go into any patients.
But to one more point, just to make sure that Doris and others who had that similar question, as Daniel and Michael said, these kind of considerations are made in the process. The FDA is making them. They're very on top of toxicity.
It's extremely strict. Actually, one of the things that industry would like to do is to use one of the reasons they like iron is that it gives them a bigger safety factor. And then the other thing they spend a lot of time worrying about is when they use metals in these reactions is getting the metals out. And there's a whole subfield of chemistry that's based around scrubbing these things out to levels that are incredibly low. The FDA is extremely demanding, and, you know.
Is it more difficult to get iron or nickel or palladium out, or are they roughly the same in terms of purification?
It seems like it's harder to get palladium out. They're only just starting to use iron and nickel more extensively, but the early reports from the people I know in industry say it seems like it's easier to get them out.
Okay. Question from Maria online. Can your panel describe what the process would be like to create a new drug for Ebola? I know, again, we've touched on these from-scratch efforts as opposed to tinkering with existing. Who knows what's exactly happening right now, but what's the process?
So actually, there's been a low level of activity for many years on this front. So it's, we're not starting, the royal we, are not starting from scratch.
Right, because it's easy to think of Ebola as something that's brand new. It's not. It certainly has become more of an issue in more places this year, but it's not brand new.
No. It's 1976 was the first description of Ebola virus. And there have been, so to use that, I guess, as a, rather than to comment where we are in the whole process of getting a drug that's effective against Ebola, to use that as a way of describing the process, you first would take the virus and grow it in conditions that you could study it safely. And you would look for molecules on a, that would inhibit its ability to replicate. And so what we do now in drug discovery for almost any new project is you do what's called a high-throughput screen. And so we can set up assays, again, we being Royal, where hundreds of thousands, in my own laboratory, we've done upwards of 500,000 compounds at a time, looking for new new molecules that have a specific activity. Once you find one, we go to folks like Dan and Michael, and we say, let's make a whole bunch of these as quickly as we can and try to improve the activity. If we know what the target is, we'll do some of the things that Dan described. We're looking at the structure of the target and the molecule and try to make them fit just like a lock and key. Once you have that, you test them in toxicity, for toxicity against a bunch of different types of cells. Eventually into animals. Hopefully there's an animal model, which there really isn't one for Ebola, which makes that very difficult, not a very easily done animal model. Primates, in other words, are the only Ebola model, which is very expensive and very difficult to do. Hopefully you have an animal model. We use some in our own research. If it works, great. You do it in another animal model. FDA requires two, so-called two animal rule. Then you move forward. And then once you get to a point where you have to say, yep, we're going to try this in humans. And is it past enough toxicity? And then you move it into phase one trial that we talked about before.
Okay, so now you're getting a look at just how that process is happening, not just with Ebola, but with so many others. Let me start to wrap our conversation in this month's Science Roundtable as we look ahead. At the end of this year, we're going to have sort of a fun hour on this program where we talk to the smartest science minds in our area and we ask them for how they think our world's going to change in 25 years. And, you know, that's always a dangerous game to play because, you know, 7 years ago we didn't have smartphones, you know. 10 years ago we didn't have YouTube. So, I know that it's impossible to know, but I'd be curious to get your takes on what you expect, at least, even if you can be as specific or as broad speaking as you like. But I'm curious to know, because your research is helping lead some of these changes that are going to impact people. And I'll start with Michael Nydig.
Well, that's a tough question, Evan. You know, certainly 25 years ago, I would not have predicted the changes we've seen now. I mean, I think it's clear, let's say, from an engineering standpoint, you know, the way technology has taken off, that will continue to grow. And one personal guess I have is that, you know, in 25 years, we may not even use laptop computers very much anymore. I think it may be a lot of handheld devices. I don't know, right? I'm not an engineer. But you know, more on the side of what we do, I think in 25 years, you're going to see in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, Dan talked about 50% of processes being palladium. I think that number will drop. And I think you'll see other metals, you know, start to take roles. And then hopefully that'll open up new directions for new types of treatments eventually.
Daniel?
Well, I think I would agree with Mike in terms of the chemistry. I think broadly speaking, so steps outside the topic of this conversation, Mike and I both work in catalysis, another front besides human health that we are really concerned about and drives a lot of our thinking nowadays is energy, specifically climate change and, you know, how are we going to mitigate the effects of climate change or get energy sources that are carbon neutral. It's the challenge, I think, of our generation. And I think in 25 years, we're going to see dramatic changes. The ability to generate liquid fuels from solar, I think, will accelerate. And I think a lot of our energy will not come from hydrocarbons.
That's another program. And by the way, that's a science roundtable that's begging to be had. Less than a minute left, Damian Creason.
I'm going to take a hopeful point of view on my field, which is infectious disease and antibiotic research, which has pretty much gone from a golden age in the 70s and 60s to the dark ages over the last 10 years. And there seems to be some grumblings and rumblings in the industry that the big players are going to get back into this game, and that we may, in 10 or 15 years, actually have new molecules and new ways to treat infectious disease that we don't have today.
Hopeful. We don't know yet.
We don't know yet.
Okay. But that's the optimistic point of view.
Which, if you talk to my lab, is a rather unusual stance for me.
Okay. or for you or for in general?
Just for me.
Okay. Just for you. All right. Well, here's hoping you're right. And thanks for elucidating this process. A really fascinating stuff. Things that are happening in Rochester, the research that is helping change the way pharmaceuticals are made, the way that there will be more options in the future for discovery and eventually for trials, and hopefully more therapies, more treatments, better treatments, and maybe even lower cost treatments. Great stuff from Daniel Weichs, who is an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry. Daniel, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Michael Neidig, an assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Evan.
Damian Creason is an associate professor, the co-vice chair of research in the Department of Pediatrics. Thank you
so much.
All right, short break. And on the topic of solar, on the topic of climate policy, what did the elections mean for climate policy? That's next hour.